Poetry, you know, whenever they've been, you know, like poetry, I think for the past 20 or 30 years has been sort of regarded as a little, you know, non-techno, not seen as a media on its own. And but if we think of the 50s and 60s and 70s with all kinds of liberation movements, there was always, you know, Allen Ginsberg and Judy Grand and you know, Amiri Baraka standing in the front of the crowd and reciting poems. Poets were always kind of the human statue giving voice to a lot of needs. And so what's been really cool with the Occupy thing is down on, you know, like last fall on rainy nights, on Friday nights at 9 o'clock, there was a crowd, which was the General Assembly, but there was always, there was also a poetry crowd. And, you know, rainy nights and tons of us will just be showing up with poems and getting this treatment, which is the oldest way that poetry is ever treated, which is that it's a human chorus, you know. So it's, I think we're all getting the opportunity to see how it really works.
My name is Amin Hussein, and I'm with the Direct Action Working Group, and I'm on Occupy Theory 2 and Tidal, the magazine, and other stuff.
Grammy Award winners Tedeschi Trucks Band brings their blues-inspired show to the Vancouver Center for Performing Arts for one night, June 19th. Tickets on sale this Friday at 10 a.m. at Ticketmaster.ca or by calling 855-985-5000. Don't miss Tedeschi Trucks Band on June 19th at the Vancouver Center for Performing Arts. For more information, go to TedeschiTrucks.com.
Well, I came to the city. I was running from.
With the vast amount of changes happening in the world, it's almost impossible to get a clear picture of what's really going on.
We are trapped within the logic of capitalism, leaving us unable to imagine what comes next.
The Extra Environmentalist brings the perspectives of people who can see the whole picture and are ready for whatever comes our way.
Tune in to The Extra Environmentalist every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Welcome to the Extra Environmentalist. Your opposable thumb means nothing.
This is what we want to be. We don't want to be Americans or Germans or English. We want to be extra environmentalists. Always feel wherever you go that you are a stranger. The outsider, the one looking in. This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Hello and welcome to another wonderful episode of The Extra Environmentalist on CITR 101.9 FM. Today we are talking with the director of The Four Horsemen.
That's right, Seth. The Four Horsemen is a film about the financial system and the economic system that we have grown up with and are now no longer being served by. And it's premiering here at the DOXA, the Doxa Film Festival, on May 8th at 1 p.m. in downtown Vancouver. And this is really exciting because we sat down with Ross Ashcroft, the filmmaker behind The Four Horsemen, last fall to talk about the movie. And so it's really exciting that one of the first places that it's in North America is here in Vancouver.
So, Justin, are we going to do some giveaways for people who want tickets?
Unfortunately not. We don't have that kind of clout as the Extra Environmentalist.
That's true. But you will be there. And anyone who wants to hang out with Justin at the film, you are more than welcome to show up.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to be going along with a few friends. So swing on by, shoot us a message on our Extra Environmentalist Facebook wall, or just get in touch with us if you'd like to join for the screening here in Vancouver.
Look for the guy with the red beard and the red hair.
The big red beard and the crazy hair. All right. Well, hope you enjoy our interview with Ross Ashcroft, and we'll catch you on the next episode of The Extra Environmentalist. So, Ross, after studying land management at the Royal Agricultural College. You worked in the film industry and did stand-up comedy, and now you're getting ready to release The Four Horsemen, which is a documentary about the economic reality we live in, exposed by interviewing leading economists and financial commentators from around the world who explain how our world really works. Just as a first question, how did you go from learning about land management and studying agriculture to directing a film about economic collapse?
Well, I spent 3 years at the Royal Agricultural College, and after that, I genuinely wanted to be a farmer and still want to be a farmer. It's a thing I love. When you leave and then go into the bad world, you realize that you can't go and buy a farm unless you inherit a farm or unless you are privy to, you know, a lot of money or a lot of capital. You can't go out and buy land. And that kind of started a bit of thinking, but a fundamental thinking, really. I realized that, you know, if I wanted to farm, what I had to go and do is go and accrue money somewhere else and then go and buy some land to do that. And really, that's where all the thinking started for what we've just launched recently.
Cool. So there's really that financial connection to starting a farm and farming.
Absolutely. And in this country, you're almost paid to farm the brown envelope, as it's called, because of the tax cuts and subsidies and all this other inefficiency in the system, if you like, which is often dictated to you from Europe or from Westminster. Farmers could be far more efficient and far more competitive globally if that system was modified, that system of grants was modified, and if the inefficiencies were taken out of it. And that's something that's incredibly frustrating. I think it's incredibly frustrating for them, and it seems odd to have such a draconian system now when food and food shortage and food supply has become the key point on the global agenda.
What did the film industry teach you that prepared you to make The Four Horsemen? Was there a major catalyst in getting you started and moving in this direction?
Absolutely. The one thing that it taught me is never sit in a development meeting, ever. Just don't do it. And I'll tell you why. By the time you sat in all those development meetings with executives and distributors and distributors and PR people and all the hangers-on, if you like, all the apparatus around the film industry, you could have made the film. And inspiration has a sell-by date. You know, you've got to get on and make it. And you've got to do it. There's no point thinking about it and saying, oh, well, for me, you know, it's a good idea, but will the people of Peru like it? Look, the point is the audience will emerge, provided you do your research and provided you can tell a story and provided you know, not a conspiracy loony and all that stuff, then your audience will emerge. It will find the film. And those development meetings, they are an absolute kill on creativity. And filmmaking now has become accessible to man on the street. You know, the old monopoly is starting to really die. And the monopoly of film distribution is on its way out. And the industry is in total disarray. The blueprint, of course, for that is the music industry. The thing I learned most from the film industry, well, two things really. To be in the film industry, you've got to get out of it. Because what can happen is you can become incredibly kind of insular, and filmmakers talk to other filmmakers with their products. And that's not good because it's aloof and it doesn't talk to a wider audience. And the second thing is don't sit in development meetings because they're the nemesis of creativity.
So we mentioned in your bio that you have a handle on how the world really works. Now, I've been struggling to understand how the world has really works for my entire life. And I'm really, really glad that we could bring an expert in on how the world works into the show. Could you tell us a little bit about how the world works and maybe explain it to somebody who's been struggling with trying to figure it out?
How long have you got?
Hey, we have the whole hour here, so.
Perfect. I mean, I know roughly what's going on at the moment, and I understand in broad terms where the world is at. But really, my job with the Four Horsemen was to get out of the way of the 23 contributors and have them speak in a way that people can understand it. So really, it's those guys who define how the world really works. And our job was to cut through a lot of the disinformation that goes on and the propaganda and all the stuff that you listen to and you think, well, that can't be right, or that you know, that just doesn't sit right, or it doesn't sound right, or what they're saying is not what I'm experiencing in either the business world or the, you know, in entrepreneurship or in society generally. So the job really was not for us to come out and dictate about how the world works with our worldview. It was actually to listen and to ask the right questions to these guys who've had incredible careers and held, you know, positions of power and really seen the system and see it work from the inside, if you like. And one of the key criteria to get the interviewees was that they have to have been through a transition. So we read a lot of what they'd written, and it was clear that all of them had started by thinking that, you know, the capitalist model as we got it is the one, and that's what we're going to push, and we're dedicated to it and committed, and here we go. This is going to set the world alight. And I think that what they've seen collectively all been through is a stage of transition where they've thought, you know what, this isn't going to work. So really it was those guys who or come together metaphorically in the same room and talk about how the world really works.
What was it like to sit in such a close, intimate setting with these unbelievably accomplished and intelligent people, or almost a comedian like Max Kaiser, right, who just make you laugh, and talk to them about such deep issues? Was there like, was the air thick with atmosphere, or what did it really feel like?
It's terrifying. Noam Chomsky, I've seen on the internet, I've read his stuff and all the rest of it, then suddenly you're sitting opposite him. You ask the first question, he answers the next five on your pad. You know, you've got to be on your game with these guys. The humility is huge, is absolutely huge. Something happens, I think, when people speak the truth, when they're speaking truth and not propaganda and not soundbite and not, politicians speak. Everyone kind of relaxes, and then that truth or that conversation emerges very naturally. And interestingly, actually, guys, when we looked at the tapes back, an awful lot of the clips that we took and put in the Four Horsemen film were clips that came often in the last 20, 25 minutes of the interview. Because what had happened during that time, you know, we'd said, well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about? You know, these guys, when they start on their area of expert passion, they drop all the mask and the things that you have to have up, the guards, the defences, when you work in big institutions or if you're on mainstream media, etc. That all dropped, and we got some real gold towards the end. A lot of the interviews, that was really interesting. But they're great, they're wonderful people.
And I saw David Corten speak, and he does a lot of work on thinking about new ways of running an economy. And he said that lies have to be told over and over again. That's why we have 24-hour news, but truth only has to be told once. I could understand that feeling, like when you're with someone and they're actually speaking about truth.
Off of what Justin's saying and off of what you said, when you're interviewing people, if you get past that, you know, set pieces that they have, you know, lined up for you, and you get past that and you can actually get into the stuff that makes them extrapolate a little bit, or makes them think and makes them improvise a little bit in what they're saying, you get the really juicy stuff off of that too.
Basically, once you get past all that stuff and they do start talking like that, you can't stop them. So Noam Chomsky, when we interviewed him in his office at MIT, his PA, and you'll hear on one of the clips in the film, a lot of kerfuffle going on outside the door because he was so delighted not to be talking to mainstream media about these issues, which often get cut and cut and cut. He was very disparaging about, in fact, the BBC. He said, what's gone on with your BBC over there in the UK? And I said, why is that? And he said, well, and we've got this on a tape. He said, well, I was over there doing an interview and someone was asking me, there was this very pretty girl asking me questions and she didn't have a clue what she was talking about. There was some other bloke behind her writing notes and feeding her the questions. And this whole thing was theatre. And I think that what happens when you're independent, you give these guys the opportunity to really speak, and their PAs get really angry because we absolutely killed the schedule.
And do you think that mainstream journalists really do research on these topics before they go in to talk to someone like that about these issues? Because I feel like so many of the mainstream stories are so shallow in probing any type of deeper financial issue.
The problem is with a 24-hour news channel and what Michael Hudson in the film calls the fire sector media, which is financial, insurance, and real estate. They basically control the agenda. And the journalist is worked to the bone by having to fill, you know, a piece at 10 o'clock, a piece at 12 o'clock. And it's very difficult to any depth whatsoever, really. And that was really important with this film. But what we didn't do, and this is what an awful lot of journalists do now, you know, it's journalism, it's in-paced journalism. So what we do is we get hold of the idea in the studio, and then we go out and make the people who we've interviewed fit our story. And that is absolutely wrong, and I'm really against it. And that's why it took so long to edit this picture, because what we did was went out and got all the talking heads, and then to serve their words as truthfully and as honourably as possible, we had to put our story around that. Now, that takes huge patience in edit, and I'm just very lucky that I've got a head of post-production at where we work, called Simon Modre, he's an editor and a storyteller, and he was so tenacious and so patient to get this story right. But, you know, people don't have that luxury. People don't have the luxury of that time. And often if there's a lot of capital behind a film, we come back to the development meetings, if there's a lot of capital behind the film and that capital needs to be repaid very quickly, or the interest on it is mounting day after day of post-production, then you, unfortunately, your hands are tied often as a writer, because you've got to get the picture out and the circus moves on. So it was about serving their words honourably and not doing the copy and paste journalism that we, I'm sure, have all been inundated with over the last 25 years, really.
Yeah, it's too bad that journalism is always on such a tight schedule. So you coming into this interview, I'm sure you guys did a whole bunch of research just before you could even talk to these people. How much of your worldview do you think was set before going into the interview, and how much of it changed after talking to these 23 guys? Did any of your core perceptions like radically shift during an interview and be like, oh, wow, I never thought of that before. That is an incredible idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, you start with your worldview is constantly changing. And I always thought that it was, when you listen to filmmakers and writers and directors, they'd say, I worked on this project and it's really changed me. You know, I would always think cynically that's just kind of, well, just Hollywood speak for, you know, trying to talk a project up. But this genuinely has, I think, changed the whole team. And the big revelation, really, guys, was that everyone's saying that capitalism has failed. And the big revelation is that it hasn't. The brand of capitalism that we have at the moment has worked perfectly according to the rules that the, I suppose, masters, if you like, have set. So, and that's sobering, because you're often sitting in a hotel room in Boston or wherever thinking, oh, well, I've been brought up to think that this is all the way to go and this is what we do. And then suddenly when you're talking to these guys who you respect, then they're telling you, no, this is actually how it works. You, yeah, as I say, it's sobering. So yeah, radical shifts in thinking.
I know when I do interviews, I'm a journalism student. I went to, did a lot of interviews during my college career. And when you're talking to somebody and they're hitting on those points that you know are going to make great storytelling moments, you just get that feeling inside of you, just like, oh wow, this is going to be so good. Did you have any of those as you're going along?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, of course, the thing is, in 90 minutes, what do you leave out? Because you know, we're really tight on edit, and we're, you know, it's about killing your babies, isn't it? And you've got to get rid of the stuff that is surplus to the story. I mean, really, if I'd have made this film my way specifically, it'd be about 19 hours long. It'd be like the Mahabharata, you know, but because there's so much to say. But yeah, of course, little just nuggets of stuff, and you think that's going in.
Yeah, and so you mentioned that you had a little bit of this idea that capitalism was failing, and then talking to all of these people, you we're hearing that it's becoming stronger in delivering the society that the power elite are desiring. Could you speak a little bit about some of the core moments that reinforced or demonstrated that this was the new reality for you?
Yeah, well, you start to look at the economics that we've, because ultimately you've got to get through all the smoke screens and get right to the root of it, right? And you can ignore all the politics, ignore all the pieces in the press about banker bashing and all that stuff, all that sensational stuff. And you've got to get right to the core. And the core is economics. And we've had, over the last 125 years, junk economics taught, basically. We've got generations of people now who are walking around thinking that they are, you know, a fay with the economics that were taught by the classical economists, and they have a rounded view of economics, and that what they've been taught is gospel. And the reality is that the economics taught over the last century is worthless, fundamentally, because it doesn't actually, well, it just does not in any way represent what goes on in the real world. That these are models and these assumptions and the all the jargon is not of this world. It is how the world ought to be in their view, in neoclassical economists' view, versus how the world actually is, which is what the classical economists always said, you know, one has to work from. So that was the revelation. And it's such a huge story, you know, that this systemic failure. Where do you start? Where do you start with it? Because it's not very, you see, when you're making a story about a banker, there's a banker in London, I don't know if you heard it today or yesterday, was arrested for fraud at UBS.
Right, and, yeah. $2.3 billion, I think, or something like that, yeah, US dollars exactly, in the trade.
Exactly, and I think they're upping it a bit now. I think they're finding a bit more. And, you know, he's become the kind of Nick Leeson of our times, if you like. So he's a whipping boy. But you see, this is the problem. What the public perceive is that if you take one bad apple out of the system can then go on and function as it should normally, or get back to normal. And Gillian Tett talks about this in the film, about the Hollywood film construction model. You know, you take the bad guy, the Bourne Identity, Jason Bourne fights the bad guy, takes him out of the system, and the system then functions perfectly again. But you see, unfortunately, that isn't how it works in the world, especially when the system is at fault. And it's very, very difficult to make a film about a system and make it cool, because people talking about systems, it's so cryptic and so kind of ephemeral. It's very difficult to kind of give it a personality. But when suddenly you've got a trader and he's got a lavish lifestyle and he's had a private education and, you know, and all the kind of stuff that surrounds that, suddenly we want to tap into that. How old is he? What? How does that reference my age? Could I have done it at his, you know, what's his background? All this stuff comes in, and they're kind of juicy bits for journalists to write about. But taking one of these guys out of the system is going to rectify the flaws at the heart of a system that, as we can now see, is under severe strain and some would argue collapsing.
And so do you think that in your film you're able to tie the system into the people that are telling you about the system, or is that just so hard to do because the system's so complex?
The system's super complex. And the reason it's super complex is it has to be super complex because Joe Sixpack, it's not good if he knows what's going on. Tariq Al-Dawani in the film quotes Henry Ford saying, you know, if people knew what was going on in the banking system, there'd be revolution before tomorrow morning. So all that jargon and all those words and all those equations, rest of it, are a necessity, really, to stop people from understanding what's really going on. So our job was to cut through all that and try and get back to big, broad basics. This isn't an academic paper. Film is there, and we paint in big, broad emotional strokes. And if we can just nudge people or evoke something in them to start the journey of working this stuff out for themselves, because, frankly, they're going to have to over the next decade to really be able to protect themselves and understand how to go forward in this very predatory system, then our job really was to light that fuse paper, if you like. And the only way we can do that is to come back to the foundations of it, of this system, and explain why it's gone wrong in the way that it has.
You're watching Celebrity in Jeopardy. This is your host, Alex Trebekistan.
Hello and thanks for joining us. I'm Alex Trebekistan, your host at Celebrity in Jeopardy. Today we're talking with radio star Alex Jones, his also infamous mother, Alex Jones' mother, and Sean Connery. film star and James Bond sometimes.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's great to be on Celebrity in Jeopardy. I hope to bring out a lot of interesting perspectives on economic collapse here during this program. I gotta say, my currency didn't fail with your mother last night.
Thank you, Sean. I appreciate your contribution as always. Today, the categories are irrational national debts, failed currencies, which square is occupied, default options, and potent potables. Alex Jones, will you start us off?
I'll take occupied squares for 1,000 euros.
This show is not done in euros, but we will start with which square is occupied for 1,000.
By euros, I meant euro meat, as they have in the failing nation of Greece.
Right, right. So, the question for 1,000. Which famous square in history involved tanks and Chinese people? Alex Jones's mother.
Well, I think that would be the, Tejiman Tujibuskushkba.
I'm sorry, ma'am, that's not correct. Alex Jones?
Everyone in the Occupy Wall Street movement is either a Bilderberger, a Bloomberger, a Big Mac burger. They're the Council on Foreign Relations taking the streets as you can see them. Everyone there is a member of the Illuminati.
Thank you, Alex, but please form that answer in a question. Thank you. Sean Connery.
Hey, Trubekistan. I thought I saw your mother in the square last night.
The correct answer was Tiananmen Square. Okay. Alex Jones, the question goes back to you.
I'll take rational national debts for 200 ounces of gold.
200 ounces of gold. Right. That would convert to 500 American dollars using the 1930s American gold standard. This nation is currently sitting on $14 trillion of national debt. Sean Connery?
Your mother's sitting on a lot more than a pile of debt right now.
Right. Alex Jones's mother.
One time I was sitting on this large bathroom pot where there was all sorts of gold in it. Alex had come back from one of his journeys with so much gold that I had to make it into a toilet bowl seat.
That was when I came back from Bohemian Grove and they were sacrificing a young virgin to the owl god Moloch. And quite frankly, they didn't need their gold anyways because they were worshipping the ancient Babylonian god. All the world leaders were there. It was insanity. I tried to sneak in through the fence, but they shot me with rubber bullets.
Oh, Alex, when's you gonna find a nice lady and just settle down? How often must I tell you?
Okay. Well, that's a great story, but no one seemed to get the right answer, so we will have to announce the right answer, which is the United States. Thank you, thank you. And it looks like it's going back to Alex Jones, who is now ranting in the corner.
These vaccines, they're coming out of FEMA camps where the vaccines are. Alex, I'll take irrational national debts for 1,000 ounces of gold.
Irrational national debts for 100,000 ounces of gold converts down to 200 on the 1920 sideways gold standard scale. And it looks like it's our daily double. This is an audio clue. The band behind this classic hit shares its name with the continent facing currency collapse.
It's the
Sean Connery.
That would be the classic 80s rock group, Antarctica.
Alex Jones.
That would be the ancient 80s rock group, the Illuminati, who are behind all this.
It seems that no one has won, and we are now all in negative numbers, much like our economy. And now it's time for Final Jeopardy. The question is, this EU member nation threatens default. That could collapse the euro. Now take your time. Make sure your answer is really good. Think carefully on your answer, because you will be paying me right now 30 pounds of gold. Now, I don't want to be taking money from the contestants, but if you continue with these terrible answers, I'm going to have to tax you mercilessly. So think carefully. Alex Jones, your answer.
The FEMA camps.
Your answer is the FEMA camps. And how much did you wager, Alex?
A stockpile of cans of beans. 2 months supply.
Right. Well, thank you, Alex. Alex Jones's mother.
Hey, Jeopardy!
Alex Jones's mother, why is your accent so strange?
I don't know where I come from sometimes. Greece is my answer.
Greece is right. How much did you wager, Alex Jones's mother?
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. Greece is what I used in the kitchen last night to bake the big cake I make.
That answer is wrong, Alex Jones's mother. Thank you for playing. Sean Connery. I hope that you have the answer that will win the day and make me not have to tax you mercilessly.
And that's right, Uzbekistan. The word of the day is Greece, and I'm using it. Greece is the word.
Greece, the country in Europe that is right now threatening to default the euro. That is correct. How much did you wager?
I wagered it was the massage oil I used on your mother last night.
Right, yes. Thank you, Sean. Once again, you have made this game unbearable. I am going to go home now and drown myself in the toilet. Thank you once again for joining us on another great episode of Celebrity in Jeopardy. Join us next week. We talk to Dick Cheney and Michael Jackson's ghost. Thank you and come again soon.
Liveband.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. Liveband.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit livemusicvancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. Liveband.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
You are listening to The Extra Environmentalist on CITR 101.9 FM, and today we're speaking with Ross Ashcroft, the director of The Four Horsemen, premiering at the Doxa Film Festival, May 8th. So let's play a clip here from Simon Johnson on understanding to cue up this next question.
You should not assume because, you know, you don't have a background in economics or in law that these issues are somehow too complex for you. They're not complex at all. It's very simple. It's about power, and it's about democracy. And you understand that just as well as I do.
Did you find that this complex system of international financial flows and complex debt mechanisms was hard to understand, or did speaking with all of these insiders simplify the story for you?
Yeah, it did simplify it, but it didn't oversimplify it. I mean, you know, look, the point is it's really very simple. And as Simon Johnson says, it's about power. It's easy to go out and buy a politician. It's easy to corrupt democracy in this way. It's easy to corporatize democracy. That's very simple. All these people who don't think that they're economists, don't think that they're entrepreneurs, or don't think that they're storytellers, you know, I beg to differ. If you're a woman in the world and doing the family shop and budgeting and understanding, you know, where the money's coming from and keeping a family moving in the right direction, all the rest of it, you're as much as an economist as a lot of these guys who sit holed up in a... In fact, I'd argue you're more of an economist than all these guys holed up in their ivory towers spitting out these equations that don't mean anything. So it is simple when you get down to it. We just got to cut through this doublespeak and this doublethink and this jargon, I suppose. But yeah, they did a superb job at simplifying it, you know, talking about banks creating money out of thin air and talking about the best tax system to implement that all the classical economists advocate. And they cut right down to the root of the issues. And that was, you know, is it cathartic? It's certainly therapeutic to hear it, because in a world where you think you're going mad, when you think, God, this is just so... intuitively, it all feels so wrong. To hear these guys actually say it was without being overly dramatic, it was kind of balm to the soul, you know?
So it's really easy to think sometimes when you think that everything is planned and everything is just going along according to somebody else's plan. How much of the world do you think is planned out and or versus the thought out and manipulated part? And maybe to take that step forward, is our world a grand conspiracy or is it just some grand incompetence that we're all just trying to scramble and react to?
It's a brilliant question, because one of the things that we did before we started making this film was we watched all the conspiracy theory films. Because if you watch the mainstream media, there's a guy in this country who was basically Tony Blair's henchman. He was his propagandist or spin doctor. His name's Alistair Campbell. And he is always very, very quick on all these panel shows, news shows, to use the word conspiracy theorist, because it's used to marginalize. I mean, when Tony Blair went into Iraq for the oil, and whenever the oil question came up, he would very quickly slap the conspiracy theorist tag on somebody, and that would, you know, do a good enough job to marginalize them. The point is that it isn't a conspiracy. The whole thing is not, you know, one kind of odd group sitting behind the curtain, pulling the strings and, you know, having people knocked off. And yeah, of course there are diplomatic fights. And of course people, there's all the, I suppose, intrigues and thriller elements of international relations between nations. Yes, there is that. But I don't think for a minute that it is possible to organize however many billion people there are now on this planet in a way to deliver a result that you want. Because think of it, why would you ever derail the gravy train? Why would the bankers or the puppet masters, if you like, ever say, you know what, this is, we're taking huge bonuses, we're taking massive paychecks home, we're living the life of Riley, there's no problems, the press aren't sniffing around, everything's going in the right direction. I tell you what, we'll have a crash. I don't think it happens like that. The crash happens because it's structurally determined. And the reason it's structurally determined is because of the junk science or the junk economics that we've taught over the last 125 years. Now, that comes to another point, and I'll be very quick. The point is that behavior in the market and the behavior in the economy, see, it's not a conspiracy, but all that behavior is determined because of the way that we treat natural resources, the way we treat the factors of production, basically. Now, the conspiracy, I suppose, has been laid about 125, 150 years ago by co-opting or corrupting the teaching of economics. So, yes, there was certainly a conspiracy back there by buying off professors and telling Ivy League universities all around the world not to teach a certain brand of economics, because that brand of economics, i.e. the classical school, and treating factors of production in a very different way to the way we teach them now, that would deliver a very, very different society, socially just, environmentally far more sound, and from an equality point of view and a quality of life point of view, it would be utopia in comparison to what we've got now.
And we recently spoke with Manfred Max Neef, and he has a book, Economics Unmasked. And one of the things that we really didn't get to talk about in depth in the interview is how in the book he does an incredible job of showing exactly what you just mentioned, how throughout history there's been all of these alternatives to our current economic systems and alternatives to neoliberal economic systems. And every single time, those systems have lost out because the neoliberal models have always reinforced the power elite of power and greed and served their purpose. And so we've really lost out, not so much in a conspiracy, a grand conspiracy, but like little ones over time that have kind of pushed away these alternatives. And that's what he really does a good job of showing in the book. But in tying it back to one of the clips that we have, the U.S. is at the core of this neoliberal model of thinking and has really extrapolated that to new heights and sent it around the world. And so we have Max Kaiser, a clip here. So we'll play that.
You know, in the U.S., there's this idea that money is God and it can do everything. And it's a very short-sighted way to run your country. And now people are, what are they going to do? Because they're run out of money. So they have nothing to fall back on. No culture, no infrastructure. When you take the money away, what are you left with in the U.S.? There's very little, you know. There's a bunch of guns, that's about it. Guns and donuts. Guns and Donuts in a 24-hour cable channel with old Ronald Reagan speeches in between Canada and Mexico. That's it. Guns, donuts, old Ronald Reagan speeches. Everything else gone. Nobody home.
What is the U.S. left with? The core values and mythos of the society are fighting harder and harder to match reality these days. And how does it look across the Atlantic Ocean from the U.K.'s perspective?
Well, look, I mean, let's start by saying that the clip that we've just heard, Max, although it's, you know, funny and he's hugely entertaining, and, you know, we went and interviewed in Paris and had a great time, it was unfortunately on the cutting room floor. And I'll tell you why. Because it's unfair to say, what else have you got apart from guns and donuts? America has got so much. It is absolutely the mentality in America, the innovation that's come out of the country, the work ethic, the people, the pride that they have generally, the service, that, you know, the list is endless. And that's why Max didn't end up in the film with that, because it's a bit damning. And although it's a kind of cheap shot, it's not our film. Now, where does it leave the US? Well, we unfortunately have to come back to this and how the UK perceives it. Look, we're pretty much in the same boat, the UK and the US, insofar as we've taught, and we're back to this junk economics thing, these economics have underpinned both societies. Now, the Chicago boys, so Manfred Max Neef, covers this, and it's, you know, it's no coincidence that a Chilean economist is talking about these things and because he's been exposed to the wilds of them, namely the Washington Consensus. And Noam Chomsky in the film talks about the first 9/11, where, you know, the Chicago boys basically went to Chile and absolutely obliterated the place, and it was their economic experiment, if you like. And to a lesser degree, the people of the United States have been subject to that economic experiment, as have the people here in the UK. Because remember, Reaganomics and Margaret Thatcher, Reaganomics were listening to Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys as much as Margaret Thatcher was. So the Thatcher-Reagan revolution, if you like, has not been helpful to society. And we're just picking the... They sowed the seed, and we're just harvesting that crop now, basically. How does the U.S. look? Well, the U.S. has got its problems. The resilience of the people will mean that they will begin to start working. Well, they'll be forced to start working these problems through. And let's just hope this time that throughout the years, as you have just said, guys, you know, we've always picked the wrong change. We've always picked it's not that the right economics were there and they were there for the taking. It's just that the neoliberal voice or the neoclassical voice got funded. That's the key point. You know, the bankers know which horse to back, and they know which one is going to deliver the most spoils. So now it's about the people beginning to unpick this. Yes, it's thorny, and yes, it's patience testing, and yes, you've got to do the work. But it's about them now saying, well, no, we've understood that this hasn't worked. So where from here? My suggestion would be to start picking a different economics.
We're hitting on a really important point. It's the people taking responsibility for creating their own reality. And I think this plays into another question that we have is, what is the role of citizen journalism in building this new society? Can people around us move from being consumers and buying into the narratives that society tells them to buy into? Is there a way to actually start creating our own stories and creating our own narratives and figuring out the directions that we personally want to move into instead of just buying into other people's stories?
I think it's a brilliant question, Seth. And I'd say this. We have just begun, we as a Western civilization, in my view anyway, something I'd call the Great Devolution. And the Great Devolution is a intuitive understanding that the moral authority, the vortex at the heart of centralized power, doesn't actually deliver anything. And if it did, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We'd all be getting on happily with our lives. So the devolution is a devolution of power across Western civilization, in my view. The question is, how do we begin to enact that? How do we start thinking in a different way? Well, when you don't have currency, i.e. money, the fundamental human currency is story. It started with cavemen painting pictures on walls, and it has helped, story and sense of humor have helped people through the most horrific times in their life, provided that the narrative is truthful and it brings solace. So citizen journalism is absolutely imperative. And in the film, what we say, we make the parallel between Gutenberg's printing press and the internet. And we say, you know, that back in the day, the spiritual gatekeepers could act as agents between the congregation and God. And then suddenly, good old Gutenberg tipped up with his cracking great press and printed vernacular translations of the Bible and handed it out. And suddenly, these gatekeepers, religious gatekeepers and royal elite, were no longer necessary. Well, you're seeing exactly the same thing with the internet, and it's very, very difficult to control. And what the internet can do, and hopefully Four Horsemen and podcasts like this and the work that you guys are doing, is the citizen journalism necessary to be able to inform the public about the truth, fundamentally. It plays a huge part, and people have to tell their stories, and they have to voice their concerns. And I think that they will. And I think that they'll do it in a way that isn't, you know, shouty, angry and conspiratorial, but in a way that allows other people to take solace. Everyone thinks, you know, it's just them suffering alone. And of course it is. And this is one of the tactics. It's hide and conquer. And when people come together and when we start mobilizing the silent majority, you start to have a very, very different society.
And how do you see your film energizing people? What do you think someone who sees your film and hears these economists talking about the grand injustices that are playing out because of the way the economic system is ordered, or, you know, maybe they listen to one of our podcasts and, you know, really feel motivated to take action? And we try to tie a lot of the things we talk about into taking action. But what steps do you think that people can take in their own lives to start addressing these issues?
It's really, really simple. And one of the things that we certainly didn't do with the film is say at the end of it, you know, on the last card, sign up to this petition, write to your politician, all this stuff that has been, I mean, it's had its role to play, but the results really over the last however many years just, well, it hasn't worked, has it? So the film leaves people with the moral obligation, because I think that signing a petition or writing to your politician leaves people with a false sense of security, really. It leaves people with hope. And hope's a false friend when it comes down to those things, because guess what? No one else is dealing with it. You've got to deal with it. You've got to go and tell your story. You've got to re-engage. You can't do the ostrich thing. The apathy is, I think Donald Reeves says that this is frozen violence. And, you know, when it explodes, then you start to see the civil unrest and all the rest of it. Well, both extremes are no good. Civil unrest is no good, and apathy isn't any good. The pendulum has to kind of hit the middle. And that pendulum being in the middle is the educated, self-educated, incidentally, which again is the internet's brilliance, self-educated, resourceful, entrepreneurial type who can navigate these issues, not sign a petition and hope that someone else is going to do it for you. Because guess what? It's no one else is doing it for you. We have to re-engage. And I think that a lot of students now going through university, going into university and leaving university are aware of this. I think that they're getting politically involved again. And, you know, one of the criticisms, say, politically, is that everyone says, oh, well, there's such apathy because no one's thinking anymore. Therefore, no one's voting. And my view is, well, everyone or a lot more people are thinking now. And that's why they're not voting, because, frankly, there's nothing worth voting for, or no one worth voting for. You know, in short, it's about this re-engaging process.
You talked a little bit about disengaging from your current society. It seems to me like you're talking about like a kind of a fundamental change in the way people think and the way that people react to their society and the way that even students are even brought up and learning about their society. Do you see a specific change in people? Is there a specific kind of person that reacts more strongly to this message than others? Are people that are more ingrained in this message less likely to give up on their society? Are younger people, like, say, Justin and myself, who are just finishing their formal education and becoming more professional, are these people more likely to be engaged in the message that you bring?
Totally. And the reason for that is that it's necessity that you're engaged, because, you know, it's not going to be plain sailing. You're not a baby boomer. You weren't born in 1948. You weren't born when all the graphs of economic growth and, you know, home ownership and economic indicators, all those graphs were going up at that time, and they're not now. You've got to adopt a more pioneering attitude. So you guys leaving uni or formal education and going into the world, you've got to go in with your eyes wide open. There are going to be people within communities who are, you know, pillars of the community. We really stand up. Now, what I'm not saying is that we're going to have a Barack Obama or, you know, a new great leader. But I think that within communities, there will be great builders. And they are leaders in their own way. But they get people together and they say, do you know what? We don't trust anyone else to look after, for instance, our pension or, for instance, our home-owning loan scheme. So therefore, we're going to do it. And this is what I mean about the devolution. So people like you, and I'm hugely hopeful about this. Yes, there are going to be teething problems. Yes, you know, there'll be the occasional cock-up on the way and things won't go quite to plan. But it means that society's starting to move back in a direction where community becomes, well, we move from this globalized dream or nightmare to a localized community that is self-sustaining and really has strong relationships and strong bonds. Because, as we say in the film, you know, it's not about money. It's not about accruing more and more and more and more. What it's actually about are human relationships. And it's about trust, and it's about love, and it's about meaning, and it's about purpose, and it's about all those things. I mean, they're the really important things. And your generation and the generations behind you coming through, Phil, certainly me, the production team on this film, and Colonel Will Kherson, fill him full of hope. He says that the one thing that he feels gives him hope over the cynicism or despair are his students, because he doesn't see the desire in them to go to Wall Street. A lot of these guys have seen how money has really corrupted an awful lot of people. A lot of the generations coming through in a post-consumer society want a different life, a different quality of life, and that's hugely encouraging.
And that's so different from the way our societies have functioned and the way our political systems have emphasized what it means to have human progress for so long. And for example, in the United States, we saw in the debt ceiling debate this classic conflict between the left and the right, where the left wanted to maintain these social programs while raising taxes, and the right wanted to cut taxes and cut spending on these, you know, quote, entitlement programs. And it seems like both sides have a point of validity to them. But the issue is that American politics and politics around the world has really changed, especially in the United States. It was always a system where a representative was elected to deliver jobs, you know, infrastructure, bridges, whatever it was, federal benefits back to their home district. And now the American political system is failing because the dynamic has changed. And what's happening is the people that everyone's electing is going to Washington and having to decide how to cut things. And it's really hard to go back to your representatives and or go back to your constituents and say, you know, I'm the one who cut your hospital, right? It's really hard to do that. And it seems the odd part is that the ideologies are only becoming more hardened. And so we'll play this last clip here.
We're seeing the bankruptcy of both traditions of the left and the right. On the left, the idea that the state can ameliorate the effects of capitalism and deliver prosperity for all and secure the poor is just no longer sustainable. On the right, the idea that unrestricted free markets and the operation of pure self-interest can also lift all boats is equally utopic and equally a product of a type of fantasy. And what's interesting is now both of those are broken and gone. Nobody is really creating an ideology for the 21st century. Nobody's creating a new patterning.
Do you think it's possible to hope for a new ideology at this point that can be enacted on a national level? Or is it really about people starting to understand that government and politics as it was is not going to be there for us in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think that at a national level, it's really tough because what we've got the specter of is protection. We know what happens when that rears its ugly head. So I think we have to divorce this huge thinking that, you know, national level and all the rest of it from man in the street and what's happening in his or her community. This left and right debate, I've never, well, certainly over the last 10 years, I haven't really understood it. I think it's glib. It's like saying, oh, capitalism and socialism. You know, is it the case that we human beings have been put on this planet And you know, we can only choose. There's only a two horse race, or there's only two choices. You know, it's either left or it's right. Or the point is, we come back to economics here, don't we? Because unless you've got your economics right, you forget the politics. I mean, famous quote about, is the economy stupid? Well, it is the economy, but globally it's the economy. And when you come down to it, it's the tax system. It's a tax system that encourages speculation in land and property, and a tax system that takes off the working man his hard-earned wealth. And that isn't it's certainly not the view of the founding fathers of America, you know, and it's certainly not the view of a lot of the really economists who've passed through the world. You can't get your politics right and then get your economics right. You've got to get your economics right and then you get your politics right. I mean, think of it. If Barack Obama had his economics right, or any leader really got it right and wasn't so short-termist, then they'd never get voted out of power. They'd be in there for life.
Yeah, that's the short-term view of all politicians, isn't it? That the four-year or the short-term time where they have it in office before they get voted out again.
Exactly. And you know, the point, I think the saying goes that a politician thinks about the next election, whereas a statesman thinks about the next generation. Now, my generation, your generation, the generation behind your generation, we've got to step up a bit, guys. You've got to leave this place qualitatively better than when you tipped up. And there's a good reason for that as well, by the way. You know, the self-serving individual, it hasn't worked, as I've said before. So dedicating yourself to a greater cause or a bigger cause is a far more fulfilling way of spending your days, in my view. And I think that the legacy that you leave is it's a healthier way to live, or even spiritually and psychologically a better way to live if you put something down which actually makes a bit of a difference for future generations. So this left versus right is, well, it's obsolete now, really. I mean, can you tell the difference between the two?
Absolutely not. More and more, I just see the policies of our current president reflecting the ones of our last, and they're from two different parties, and they're supposed to be very diametrically opposed. But all they do is prop each other up. It's the A all over again, you know.
It's like WWF wrestling, isn't it? So what's the problem? The problem's the economics.
So the problem is the far thinking, the long term thinking that we just talked about. This is a question we kind of ask. We bat around back and forth on this show a lot. Is one, how to get people to think long term, and then if you take a step back from the now and you think about what this situation is going to look like, and then what the future is going to look like, and people in the future looking back on our situation now and seeing the tumultuous times that we're going through and the growing pains that are our species as a whole and our planet as a whole, where do you see the future of humanity going in, you know, 10 years and 20 years? Where do you see us ending up? What sort of place is it going to be when humanity finally figures out all these little quirks in our nature and figures out the correct path for our planet?
Of course, we've got to stay light and bright. We really do. This is going to sound glib, and I don't mean it. We've got to understand that this whole thing that we've got at the moment is a game. Because quite frankly, if you started taking all this seriously, you go mad. And if you look at the level of stress in the Western world now, and the level of disease, dis-ease, you look at the level of relationship breakdowns, and all the indicators that we don't need, alcoholism, drug abuse, etc., the big question that you're asking, I think, is how do you start to reverse that? How do you start to get those indicators and get those indices down, or getting them going in the right direction? You know, I'm sorry to be really boring, but you've got to come back to how you organize your society economically. Because, you see, people are both reasonable and good, generally. I mean, of course, there are crackpots in the world, and there are loonies and all the rest of it. And there are some people who go and do heinous things. And yeah, there is an element of that society. But if you take the view that most people are reasonable and good, then what follows is, okay, if that's the case, how do we create an economic system, a tax system, a society that allows their inherent good to flourish? And that's called Renaissance, right? When human beings in a time of darkness, suddenly a society works out how to get it right. And what happens is there's this huge overflow of human potential. And you can't have that. And I'm not being overly utopian or Panglossian. what I'm saying is you can't have that if man on the street is constantly being persecuted for doing productive work. It can't happen, because you spend your days being beaten back and being beaten back by predatory finance, by a predatory capitalist system, and we will never progress. We're like gibbons who trash a tree, right, and then move on to the next tree. But the point is this: we've got a world, and I'm not sure where we're going to go next once we've trashed this one. So we've got to kind of get out of this.